Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. Today we have Yahi Lawabidi, and I have my co-host Richard Modigliano, and here we go.
Well, welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Today we are talking to Yahi Lawabidi, whose book, Learning to Pray, A Book of Longing, New and Selected Poems and Aphorisms, is available from Kelsey Books. We're going to go back to that at the end, but tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure thing, Richard. Thank you guys for having me on. I am Egyptian, born Egyptian, but my father is Lebanese. I was born and raised in Egypt, and at some point during college, I moved to the States. I went to college in D.C., George Washington University, and then went back to Egypt, worked at the UN for 10 years as a speechwriter, got restless, and then made the U.S. my home ultimately for the last 16 years. That's kind of very broadly speaking my background, but I'm happy to fill it in if you'd like more.
Well, what I would like to do, the more that I would like is, what turns you to poetry?
You know, that's a mystery. I think it's an inner compulsion. It's a survival mechanism. There's a great mystery aspect of it. As a kid, I was drawn to reading. I was a reader before I was a writer. I think that's the way it typically goes. But I wasn't reading poetry necessarily until maybe late teens. I was exposed to Gibran, Khalil Gibran, early on. Having a Lebanese father, Gibran is an inescapable influence. And reading him at 15 or so, I was just struck by the power of the language initially, because I couldn't grasp some of the concepts, but just the way he was able to fuse philosophy, poetry, and spirituality, which I hadn't an inkling what that was about. But it seemed so beautiful and transporting and profound and simple. The language was very simple. Later, I learned that he was influenced by Blake and Nietzsche and the Bible and all these heavyweights that I later explored. But I think Gibran may well have been my first introduction to poetry. And then, you know, in school, one is exposed to, you know, Eliot meant a great deal to me also as a teenager. Wilde, as a teenager, was someone who introduced me to sort of these witty, wise sayings. I didn't know what aphorisms were then. But it was as a reader that I happened upon it and then at some point thought to emulate it.
And when did you start writing poetry yourself?
Bad poetry as a teenager that I wouldn't share. And mercifully, this was before the internet, so there's nothing even floating around for anyone to uncover. And then kind of more seriously, probably somewhere in my mid-20s, late 20s. And at some point I realized, okay, this is something that is giving me some sort of relief, deep relief, and I began to read it more seriously and to write it with more commitment.
And did you start out writing in English or?
Always. I went to American schools as a kid. I speak Arabic fluently. It is my mother tongue, but unfortunately, I never got around to studying Arabic formally, because it was offered as a second language in the school that I went to in Egypt. And it was so basic and rudimentary that I thought, I don't need to be told, you know, how to say ball and cat and run. So I thought, I can just do that on my own. We did have tutors at home, which were not effective, and I was not committed. And I ended up taking French as a second language, and I never, ever sort of went back to properly studying the language. So I can read it with some difficulty, or rather slowly, but I'm not confident enough to write it.
Well, it seems to me that somebody that is familiar with languages other than their native tongue gets an insight into language itself, because people that are monolingual, they know their own language and they take it for granted. They don't see it as something mysterious and potent for the most part. But somebody that knows more than one language knows that there is a lot in language that's what we have different languages, because there are ideas that are formed in a particular language and come out in that language. And so it seems to me that knowing more than one language throws light on the other languages and gives you a certain understanding of them. Even though you only write in English, the ability to speak in other languages and the fact that you studied French, it seems to me, and I can tell this from your work, gives you a tremendous insight into the way language works.
That's very kind, and I think it's true to a large extent. The same can be said, of course, of cultures. If you come from or straddle more than one culture, you realize that no one culture has a monopoly on truth or the human experience, and that in a sense they're all inadequate and they're all pieces of a puzzle, and it's just enriching to be exposed to more. At the same time, I will say that I've come to believe lately that all language is inadequate in the sense that one can never fully unburden themselves or grasp the ineffable in any language. You're always sort of straining with imprecise nets and instruments to capture something, you know, whether you want to call it the spirit or you want to call it something ineffable. The human experience itself cannot quite be satisfactorily summed up in language. So we try our very best, of course, and it's always fingers pointing to the moon, but it's never quite the moon itself.
Yeah, exactly. That brings us to your book, which I'd like to talk about now. The title of the book is Learning to Pray, and I notice in your preface, you say that poetry is how we pray now. And could you expand on that before we get to some of the poems themselves?
Well, I mean, I was not raised, despite coming from Egypt and that part of the world, I was not raised in a typically religious background. We didn't go to the mosque, for example. I was culturally Muslim in the broad aspect of it, but not practicing in any manner. And so art became the way for me to approach the sacred and to sort of sanctify life and to lend it that tremendous, numinous dimension. And now, you know, I living in the States, I'm very much aware that, you know, with the exception of some extreme factions, it's not a particularly religious culture. It's a culture where people are more comfortable identifying as spiritual, if anything, rather than religious. And when people don't have that, they still hunger for beauty and profundity and all this and the mystery that is found in faith, but they can find that or they find that temporarily, at the very least, in art. And as someone who turns to art for solace and sustenance, I began to see that poetry can remind us of these depths that go by other names. It can steer us in that direction and give us the same sort of solace that prayer and faith can. Or at least a certain type of poetry.
Well, that brings us to, I wonder if you would read the poem, the title poem, Learning to Pray, because I think that this goes right to the heart of what you were just saying, and it's a beautiful poem in and of itself.
Thank you, sir. Happily, because actually that's the poem that dictated the book, really. So the title is Learning to Pray. Long susceptible to the pious heresies of mystics, martyrs, and other fanatics, mad enough to confound themselves with God and declare it free of ego. Those spiritually reckless creatures, contemptuous of all rule books, traffic signs, and speeding tickets, in such a hurry were they to arrive. No social drinkers, these revelers. They drank to get drunk alone, that they might stay that way, sobriety being the only sin. But what of us, without stamina for such superhuman attention, or the patience to stand in line, inching towards the checkout? Might we forge our own language until we can speak in tongues? By asking of our every action, does this or that please you?
And this is it. What I like about so much about this poem is that it brings the spiritual down to earth. The evocation of mundane things, driving your car, traffic signs and speeding tickets, social drinkers, people getting drunk, waiting in the checkout line. These are all mundane things, but when you, in the context of your poem, they become metaphors for the spiritual life. And I think that was that's really terrific, I think, a wonderful way of putting it. Because as you said earlier, the language is direct. It can be grasped by the average reader. And it's what you bring to a poem like this that reveals its depth. And it's the kind of poem that's good enough that you can read more than once and get more out of it. And I really like that. I really think that's what makes a good poem to me.
That's very kind. Yeah, I was just from the very start sort of suspicious of poetry because I didn't like it, the idea of it being a private club or exclusionary in any way. So I'm grateful to hear you say that that it does bring things down to earth, because I would like to think that people who don't particularly care for poetry might pick this up and resonate. It may connect with them on some level.
And it does exactly that. And another one that I like that it's also of tremendous beauty is Desert Revisited. I wonder if you could read that one.
Yeah, I don't remember. Was that in this book, or is that
in this book. It's on page 27 in the book. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'm happy to read that. That actually branched out into a larger project of a sort of new booklet, chapbook, that I published after this called Desert Songs, which is
just sort of these love letters to the desert.
Yeah. But
we'll talk
Desert
about that
Revisited
briefly later
year.
On, but... Okay. Go ahead.
So, Desert Revisited. Under a whirling skirt of sky, streaming light and stars, groping for that tremendous hem, gingerly over quicksand, as though steadied beneath some tongue and dissolving, not the absence of sound, but the presence of silence, or as if transfixed by a gaze, stern, serene, surveying a dream, foreign, familiar. Incorruptible starting point, inviolable horizon, where eye and mind are free to meditate perfection. There, begin to uncover, buried in dust and disinterest, the immutable letter, first of the Arabic alphabet, Alif. Under the ever-watchful eye, fearsome sun, forgiving moon, bless the magnificent hand. All else is blasphemy, a lie. Experience quietude, the maturity of ecstasy, longing to utter the unutterable name. Only striving, supreme or pure, can ever hope to endure the absolute face, the awesome embrace.
And this is another poem of tremendous depth. My take on it, when I in that very first verse, under a whirling skirt of sky, I immediately thought of Sufi dancers.
You wouldn't be mistaken.
And the ecstasy that is behind the dance itself, which imbues the poem, and it's not like it's a quiet ecstasy, as I see throughout the poem. It's an appreciation of life. Mm. And then later on, I also like this, the fearsome sun, forgiving moon. And of course, culturally, you know, the sun is associated with the masculine, the father, the male, and the moon is with the mother, the forgiving mother, the nurturing mother. And I
very
like
nice.
How that comes up in there. That was really wonderfully done.
Yeah,
and then
the moon is very special also within my culture. It's first of all, we follow a lunar year, but also the loon is a term of endearment. If you wanted to pay a lady a terrific compliment, you'd say she was like the moon. So the moon, yes, I do agree, is feminine and has sort of this special place, especially the idea of night. You know, however harsh the day might have been, the night, there's something absolving, the cover of night, the moon is a gentler light. So, yeah, thank you for noticing that.
Yeah, and then finally, the final stanza, only striving supreme or pure can ever hope to endure the absolute face, the awesome embrace. This is basically what we are talking about when we, if you have a spiritual relationship with God, with whatever is greater than yourself, whatever you choose to call it,
mm-hmm.
if your heart is open to that, then you have this, then the embrace is indeed awesome. And the use of the word to endure the absolute face, it basically makes you melt away, and that is why the face is absolute and the embrace is awesome to me. This is my own particular take on it. These are the thoughts and feelings that this wonderful poem evokes for me.
Yeah, no, you know the thing is, Rich, I remember when I was writing this, I wasn't quite fully cognizant of what I was groping for something, and I felt that I'd experienced something meaningful, but I didn't quite know how to give it a name because I didn't have any practice of any sort. I was not committed to a spiritual life. I was just in the desert in Egypt on a retreat, as I tended to do, let's say, you know, for a few weeks, a month at most. And it was just a way of, you know, getting away from the maddening city. Cairo is a beast. And sort of emptying myself of all of its noise, but also emptying myself of all of my noise and trying to just be still or silent and overhear something I couldn't hear in the din of the city, in the busyness of my life. And this is what I heard. This is sort of what I felt the desert was whispering to me. And I really didn't make much sense of it. I mean, I remember writing the poem and being very struck by the experience of it. But I don't think I benefited from it fully till a good decade or two after the fact, when I began to sort of understand that these were my first gropings towards a sort of spiritual life. And this is what I was yearning for without even knowing it.
Well, it's wonderfully expressed in that poem. Another poem, since we are talking about the limitation of words, is titled Words. And I wonder if you could read that one for us. It's on page 44.
I'm very grateful to you for pointing the way because I'm a bit of a space case. Here it is. This is one of the earliest poems, I think, that I wrote. This is very much like you said, marveling at words and also realizing their limitations. Words are like days, coloring books or pickpockets, signposts or scratching posts, fakirs over hot coals. Certain words must be earned, just as emotions are suffered, before they can be uttered, clean as a kept promise. Words as witnesses, testifying their truths, squalid or rarefied, inevitable, irrefutable. But words must not carry more than they can. It's not good for their backs or their reputations. For whether they dance alone or with an invisible partner, every word is a cosmos, dissolving the inarticulate.
Well, that's great. That's the similes in this poem are so apt in basically defining what words are and how they function. And it's to me the poem. You say this is one of your earliest poems.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's extremely accomplished to me. It's like every stanza is excellent, I thought. And what I particularly like, certain words must be earned just as emotions are suffered before they can be uttered. I really like that. I mean, I think that expresses a profound truth for me.
Well, this was sort of a warning to myself as a glib young artist not to overreach, to recognize that there's a sanctity to language, and one has to be equal to the words they use, because these are entities, these are living entities, and one cannot just toy around with them in an irresponsible manner.
And the final two lines, every word is a cosmos dissolving the inarticulate. I mean, it's so true. I mean, if you... The etymology of words is that cosmos, because the whole backstory of how a particular word came into existence, it carries so much with it. And putting the word to use does dissolve the inarticulate, if you know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. They're magnificent things, words. They're so great that one expects everything of them, and when they fall short, you know, one stamps their feet and says, no, they didn't give me everything. But they're tremendous things, words.
Yeah. And of course, it is the usual way that we communicate. And, of course, for decades, I mean, it's how we preserve history. And, of course, as we know that, according to linguists and historians and prehistorians, there is a long oral tradition behind the very earliest literature. If you go back to, in Chinese, the Book of Songs, which is about 3,000 years old, they hypothesize that the Book of Songs existed for probably 1,000 years before it was written down. So,
oral traditions definitely are aware of the power of language and storytelling to preserve communities and philosophies and much else.
Listeners, this is why this book is really worth having. It's really wonderful. From each poem in it is a gem in my view, and I enjoyed it very much. Another one that I'd like has a slightly different mood to it. Turning on the Faucet, which is on page 50.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what you make of it. This is a strange poem for me. Turning on the Faucet. What harrowing reproaches from the depths delivered with world historic accent, as though clearing a throat spoiled by long use or disuse. To bewail an ancient crime, cries of wrathful deities, growling, hungry howls of cavernous cravings, or strange pathos echoing memory's dizzy playground in plaintive desert serenity. such size of fearful spirits in limbo, somehow unliving and undying, wandering in the land of shades, startled from much dreamed of sleep, hollows aching with arthritic creak into reluctant and rusty service. What weird music from breathing flutes, moving water, steel and air in treaties. Oh, that sublime singing of the pipes. Sublime in the sense Milton meant it, the beauty that hath terror in it.
And this poem is taking off from when I read this, I thought, well, this is the sound of old rattling inspires.
That was literally that was the start. Yeah,
inspires this wonderful poem that it shows the way the imagination of a poet works. So listeners, I mean, if you, this is a poem that I really want to draw people's attention to, because this is how imagination works in a poet. So from something as mundane as noisy pipes comes this beautiful poem. And all of the ideas that come up, clearing a throat spoiled by long use or disuse, well, of course, that makes complete sense, because somebody that is chanting or talking for a long time, you know, your throat, you have to clear your throat at a certain point. Or if you've been silent for a long time, that's the same thing.
That's it.
And then
that's it.
To bewail an ancient crime, that is the thing that's being articulated. And then we have the idea of the cries of wrathful deities, the sighs of fearful spirits in limbo. These are all wonderful associative ideas, and that really, as a reader, if you enter into the poem, your own imagination can go off in all directions. And the final stanza, sublime in the sense Milton meant it, the beauty that hath terror in it. And this goes back to something that Robert Graves said in his book, The White Goddess, where he said that, where his whole thesis, whether we agree with it or not, it's still interesting, that all poetry is a kind of prayer to what he called the goddess, and the evocation of her in all of her beauty and terror. So that maybe he was thinking of Milton when he wrote that, but that was my immediate thought, and that is something that really happens in this poem. It's so expansive.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for your close readings, because sometimes the poet sort of is the last one to take a poem apart, and it's nice to hear what it means for other people. But yes, this one was sort of a bit of a surprise to me, because it was such a mundane trigger, and yet I ended up with all of that, and I thought, good God, where is this coming from?
And then we're almost out of time, but I wonder if we could hear one more poem, Nightbird, which is on page 54.
Sure. This is a more recent one, and sort of a reminder to myself, I suspect, not to get too carried away by all the distractions that life offers. Nightbird, how night descends, enveloping us in its great sacred wings, with the promise of a deeper silence than day dared to offer. Now, if only we can endure this tremendous stillness, we might still be restored to ourselves once again. Tread lightly, cover the smiling mirrors and sullen screens. Don't let any spirit escape through the thousand and one trapdoors. Listen, those are your own footsteps you hear approaching. Don't look around or move much. Enemies of the holy hush crouch nearby. They want your attention in pieces, smashed like a porcelain vase. The quiet majesty of your mounting wholeness disturbs them more than anything else. Try with all your might to make it last the night. As you tremble and sweat, remember this triumph next time you forsake your oaths.
And that's another poem packed with so many ideas and so much meaning in it. I wish we could go on, Yahia, but we didn't get to the aphorisms, which are a nice contrast with the first part of the book, because aphorisms, and they're all really good. The behind aphorisms is the exercise of wit and the puncturing of pretense, and also a kind of there's a sort of a self-criticism involved as well. And so, readers, you're going to have to get the book to get to the aphorisms. We are out of time. We've been talking to Yahia Lababidi, a wonderful Egyptian poet residing here in the U.S. The book is Learning to Pray, and it is available from Kelsay Books. That's K-E-L-S-A-Y Books. You can buy it at their website. And I do urge you to support small presses, because they are the ones that are taking the risks by printing cutting-edge work. You won't find this in the big major presses. They don't want to take any risks. They're all about the bottom line. So a small press does absolutely deserve your support. So check out Lahia's book there. Lahia's book there. By the way, do you have your own website by any chance?
I don't. It's one of the things I never got around to doing. But if people just punch in my name, stuff will come up all over the place. So it's scattered. You have to dig for
it. That's great. Well, Yahia, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I very much enjoyed your book. And listeners, consider giving this book for a Yule present, Christmas present, or Kwanzaa present. It's really wonderful. It's worth it. Thanks again.
I'm very grateful for your attention and this representative sample of the reading.
Been another episode of Poet Runner. Please come back again and please buy his book. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.